This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
A new Democratic candidate for Congress in the 13th District is taking aim at sham test votes on proposals in Washington meant to flush out lawmaker positions for later attacks.
All of that is show. All of that is a lot of theatrics, which bring about an outcome, but then it also brings the system into question.
Meet candidate and U High theater teacher Ben Webb. Plus, Heartland Theater opens a festival of 10-minute plays, hate crimes are rising in Illinois, and get an introduction to one of the GLT summer concert headliners, Thornetta Davis. And a GLT news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. There is another candidate in the Democratic race for Congress in the 13th District. He is Ben Webb, an English and drama teacher at University High School in Normal. Webb says he's been frustrated at the lack of listening done by the current Congressman Republican Rodney Davis and believes he brings a different approach. Webb first tackles the question why he wants the job.
Well, I think it's an interesting question. It's been one I've been trying to rationalize since the November election. It's been discussions with family and friends and noticing that nobody is really able to take the back seat anymore. We're seeing politics that have overwhelmingly exhausted us and our time and our resources. We're marching for causes that we know to be true, that we're trying to show the rest of the world that we believe in this, this is valuable, and yet somebody's not listening. And so I was always taught, I was always of the opinion that representation should reflect the views of the people. And so part of what I'd like to see in this election is what are the values. I think an educational voice, an educated opinion is needed for this process. And this district especially has 11 different colleges. And with that mentality, with that idea, you can learn a lot from your constituents. You can learn a lot from what they tell you, how they communicate to you. And I feel that that voice is definitely needed this time of year, but also in this upcoming election.
Let me ask you to unpack a certain phrase, though. Nobody's willing to take the back seat. So is that a vote for me, I will compromise in order to get governance done? Or what do you mean by that?
I don't see it as a compromise. I think all politics and all public office is an understanding of opinion, especially in this district with a number of educated individuals. We can articulate our ideas in phenomenal ways. And with my background in education, I'm supposed to take my cue from my students. My students teach me what they understand, how they understand something, and there are some things in my classroom, for instance, that are just in error. Comma doesn't go there. This is grammatically incorrect. Your interpretation of this passage is not what's been said by the author in this other place. And so it's always based on evidence. So I don't see it as a compromise as much as a willingness to listen and a willingness to learn. Even if there is a fundamental disagreement on the philosophy behind a policy or a value, really what it comes down to is a willingness and ability to actually listen to the other side and then to articulate the objection back. So it's more about communication. It's more about the rhetoric that's being used. And in the end, there are going to be values that we disagree on, and fundamentally we'll not be able to find middle ground or even a way to build that bridge between those two sides. But when it comes down to it, it's more about the communication. It's about the actual process of coming to an understanding for each other.
You mentioned the 11 colleges and universities in the district. That would indicate that higher education is a strong plank in your campaign. What about it do you hope to promote?
Well, I've been very, very fortunate to see a level of activism from young people in this district, which is it's just very heartwarming, and it's very hopeful. We have a lot of individuals, a lot of students who are seeing what's happening, and really the outcome that needs to come from this is voter engagement. The level of activism, none of us can really take that back seat and stop trying to promote these values, specifically with my views and some of the views that I've been articulating through the campaign, is a populist perspective as well as a Democratic voice that is willing to stand up for healthcare, economic growth, but also an understanding and an ability to address the real issues and to think ahead more than just an election. My background is in education. I'm not a politician. And a number of people who have said, this is great, this is really kind of surprising that you're wanting to do this. Part of what they've then said is, don't become a politician. And I think part of what a number of individuals are seeing is that we don't trust politicians anymore. We don't trust those that have been put into office because something's wrong with the system. I think there's a fundamental change that needs to happen. Outside of school, one of my 1 o'clock juniors was studying for the AP US government test, and they brought me their textbook. And they said, could you just quiz me for like 10 minutes before I go and try and cram some more? And a number of issues that were brought up in the textbook, I just go to a page and ask a question. And I would then, in the follow-up to the question, so what is the Dawes Act? How many votes does it take to get a law passed in the Senate? And one of the things that was very interesting is that from that discussion, the conversation was, well, that doesn't sound very efficient. That doesn't sound very practical. It doesn't sound like that's actually helpful. And he kind of said, yeah, but that's the way it is. There's no way to fix it. There's no way to make it better. And so I think part of what people are wanting to see is a little bit of sanity, because we are trying to understand what's occurred since this November election. And all of us with informed opinions are kind of looking and going, well, what's the change that is needed, and how can we bring about that change?
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Ben Webb, who's announced he is a candidate for Congress in the Democratic primary in the 13th Congressional District, hoping to win the slot to take on Congressman Rodney Davis, the Republican incumbent. Current Education Secretary Betsy DeVos is quite firm on increasing charter school participation, and quite firm in hewing to the Trump-submitted budget, which would eliminate funding for special needs kids and a number of other categories that help K-12 schools through federal aid because of low-income guidelines. Where do you stand on those kinds of proposals?
As an advocate for a number of special needs programs, including Special Olympics, as well as the Penguin Project in McLean County, which is having their performance this weekend, I have never really understood this administration's rationale behind education as a budgetary expense rather than an investment. I see no better investment than in our schools, in our teachers, and in professional development to then bring about a stronger future for both these future leaders, but also the individuals who are then going to inherit this world as government officials, as politicians, as lawyers, as doctors. And so I don't understand the cuts that are being made to education. That being said, I, ever since college, have looked at this and said, well, budget cuts in education are just inevitable. You will never be funded enough. And so one of the things that I've been very adamant about promoting on our website is fully funded education. Why would we do anything less? Why would we ever do 90% of a budget? Why would we ever do cuts to programs that provide meals to students of diverse backgrounds? Or specifically, probably the better way to explain it would be, why would we ever make cuts that are there to benefit all people of all ways of life? And in programs, especially in lower socioeconomic statuses, in impoverished areas, why would we hurt the future of those individuals? And so I would love to see a change in the rhetoric that's being used by our current education secretary, because, quite frankly, the cuts to special needs and the cuts to special education that are being proposed, as well as Medicaid, it's going to have some long-lasting implications.
The Trump administration is proposing those cuts in partly to pay for an increase in military spending. What is your big picture approach to budgeting? What wins, what loses, and how would you balance a budget, which actually hasn't really been addressed for some decades?
Well, and I think it's also important that we're looking at balancing a budget in our own state, and we've had limited success in passing a budget. We have had no success in passing a budget. And so I think part of what's really crucial with the budgeting is that social programs, education, healthcare, those are some major priorities. And when you look at our military spending, we're spending an astronomical amount right now. And yet we're talking about making cuts to programs that are going to impact the livelihood of individuals here in our state, across the nation. And yes, military spending is necessary, but the idea of making cuts to fundamental programs that benefit human lives and their livelihood here in the states for the purpose of then increasing military spending, I feel that that's a little misguided.
You've mentioned healthcare a couple times now. What ground do you plan to hold on that?
Well, I think it's important that we look at how we can move to a single-payer system. The current coupling of healthcare to employment is, and if we look at the ACA, it is in need of improvement. It's in need of, rather than repealing and replacing, we actually need to get down to how this was created and how we can actually make a system that provides this right, not a privilege, to all individuals, all Americans. One of the important milestones of what we're looking at as a campaign is our ability to then provide that right rather than looking at the repeal and replace. Because in many ways, the system that was designed with the intention of, in a while, we can go back, we can repeal it, we can remove it, we can see it fail. But also the rhetoric that's being used around Obamacare is very much showing that it has failed. A number of things that have been published by GOP senators and representatives, it's saying that it is failing. It's saying that it is hurting Americans. And yet the cuts that we're looking at right now are very clearly going to cut and remove people from the insurance that they have. And so we need to look at that. We need to actually address that. And I think it's important that we are making sure that healthcare providers are involved in that discussion. For a number of years in education, we follow the legislation, the rules that are provided by our politicians. And so it'd be very interesting to see what the experts, doctors, patients, insurance companies could be a part of that discussion, but they should not own the conversation. And I think bringing it to the people is what's actually going to bring about a system that helps everyone.
How would you pay for single payer?
Well, that's the important aspect, and I'm not an expert on that category. I think with all of these programs, you really have to look at how we are paying for anything.
Do we increase taxes? Do we cut the military substantially? Do we do things to entitlements that would cause people to contribute more? Or what's your general approach to paying for these things?
I think the general approach is that cuts to the military, while it would bring about, it would actually open up a number of funds that could then be allocated to healthcare, I don't see it as the silver bullet that actually solves the problem. Raising taxes could bring about that change. I would say it's a complex answer, and I'm not exactly sure how. I think a number of these programs, a number of these initiatives, the question always comes down to how can we pay for that? And I think what's important is you're bringing the experts to the table. You bring in the economics majors. You bring in the poli-sci majors. You bring in all of these individuals that are experts in this field, and they can actually crunch the numbers. They can actually do the math that will show this is how it impacts high-wealth individuals. This is how it impacts low-wealth individuals. This is what it's going to do for all the demographics. I think what you don't do is you don't try and shove a vote, or you don't try to push a vote in the craziest way possible. And I'm basing it off of what I've read. And I think what's really important is all of that is show. All of that is a lot of theatrics, which bring about an outcome, but then it also brings the system into question. It asks, what is the real goal here? Is it to say we got the job done? Is it to say that this is better and this is why it's better? Don't question us. I think in the end, you have to bring in the experts. And I think that's something that's lacking. We do look to politicians for all the answers. And I think what's important is that in surrounding yourself with the actual experts, those that can give you the non-polarized, non-biased information that's not going to promote partisanship or just self-interest, that's where you're going to actually get the real answer. And that's where you can kind of find ways to either increase spending in one area to then bring about a specific outcome, or you might have to cut other programs that are not being efficiently run. And so I think it's a mixture.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Democratic candidate for Congress in the 13th District, Ben Webb. There are at least two other announced or likely candidates. One of them has formed an exploratory committee, State Representative Carol Amons of the Champaign-Urbana area, and David Gill, the physician who has run six times before. Distinguish yourself from those and from the other people who are also doing exploratory meet and greets.
It is a populated area. It's kind of nice to see how many different individuals are running. And I think part of what's really beneficial about this process is that the voters are then able to say, this is where we think this individual will best serve. You've got a current representative with a great track record. You've got a physician who has run in the past and has expressed his interest in running. I think the thing that I bring to the table is a newness, but also just an outside opinion and a willingness to be open to learning. As an educator, I value that learning process and that ability to, with an open mind, hear the other side of the argument and potentially be convinced based on the evidence that's being presented. I feel like that openness and that ability to engage in a learning process is really significant, really important, especially in this current atmosphere where we have a current representative who, while he says that he will listen and he will be open to the suggestions of his constituents, on a number of occasions you have a lack of town hall, which a number of his constituents have requested, constricted office hours that are not really accessible to working individuals. And so I think part of what I would like to bring to the table, besides that level of communication, is another option, an additional option for the voters to say, as an educator, can I learn from you and can I be your voice in this larger, in this specific space?
How will you appeal to the largely conservative voters in some rural areas in the central part of the state and in the southern part of the state who make up a big chunk of the voting base?
I think that's important. I think part of what needs to be done is it needs to be ongoing dialogue. We in this day and age kind of stick to our own media circles, our own friend groups. And I think what's important is that we need to start having the crosstalk with individuals outside of those small bubbles. It's important to bring in number of voices, number of outside parties, but also just to kind of have that sit down and say, this is where you stand. Why do you stand there? And I think part of what's going to come from this discussion, a number of meet and greets, but I think part of what I'd like to see is ongoing dialogue between all voices, not just conservative, not just liberal, but I'd like to see the conversation occur. And if I can be a part of that process, I'd like to try and change that system right now. Because right now it is very much, I'm going to surround myself with people who are going to agree with me. I'm going to surround myself with individuals who already believe the same things that I do. And I think part of what the discussion needs to be is, we shouldn't wait for a debate to then talk about the issues and to share, this is my stance on a specific topic. I think it's important to be having those as you campaign, as you say to the people, this is why I'm running, this is my stance, what is your response? And then to actually listen to that response and then to kind of hear what they have to say.
Running for Congress is expensive.
Yes.
Some people, some potential candidates in this cycle have said, you know, I can't afford to run. I can't afford to take a year to 18 months off of my job and not earn any money. I can't afford to take nearly every waking minute and place it on the phone raising money to the tune of $100,000 to $200,000 a month, every month until the election. How will you approach the technical aspect of a meaningful run for Congress?
Well, I think that's the important part, is you want to have a meaningful run, and you want to show that the constituent, you want to show the constituents of your area that this is real, this is something you actually want to do. And part of what I've done this year is I've communicated to a number of friends and family that I don't intend to stop being a teacher. I've communicated to a number of students that artwork is already created for next year's performances, and I'm working on press releases for shows that we'll be doing next school year. Part of what I want to try and bring to the table is that I don't want to say I'm a teacher and then stop teaching. I want to be able to divide and show this is my ability to be an instructor, and then this is my other priority, which is representing those of this district. And so fundraising is going to be an obstacle that I'm looking to hopefully engage with community leaders, with a number of political activists in our area, both in the Bloomington-Normal area, but also in the Champaign-Urbana area. And I'm looking for that assistance, but I'm also looking for that reasonable understanding, because I don't plan on stopping in my classroom. I do plan on teaching English literature in my freshman classes next year. I do hope to be involved in the theater program next year, because that's where my passion is, that's where my background is. And my students will see that. My students are going to be a priority. And I think part of that is communicating the message that this is my job. If the job of a congressman is to listen to the people, then I'd like to also see that from our current representative. I'd like to see that he is responsive to the individuals that he is representing.
Ben Webb, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
There are at least two other probable Democratic candidates already, State Representative Carol Ammons of Champaign-Urbana and Bloomington physician David Gill, who has run six times before. A handful of other people are also exploring the possibility. Republican Representative Rodney Davis of Taylorville is the incumbent.
Support for GLT comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, a look at Illinois hate crimes. Heartland Theater in Normal is taking 10 minutes, that is, to give you a play from start to finish. GLT's Laura Kennedy has more.
Bit by bit, minute by minute, Heartland Theater has built up a sterling reputation around its annual 10-minute play festival, which is currently underway. Artistic director Reese Lovell says 10-minute plays are becoming more and more popular in the theater in general. Heartland's 10-minute play festival began 15 years ago. And at the time, Lovell remembers the plays were required to have a theme that was site-specific and focused on a particular place.
Versus an idea or something more abstract. So that very first year, the place was the front porch.
I remember that.
And in the years since, we've gone to a number of different locations, including the back porch, funeral parlor, attic, and then at a certain point, we started exploring this other idea of abstract ideas like one shoe or 20 years. And it just happens that this year's theme is a little bit of both. It's a graduation party, which isn't necessarily site-specific, but it can be. It's always chosen a year in advance so that we can put the word out to playwrights who want to submit, because the earlier they submit, the quicker we can give them feedback, which we try to do. The problem is it's gotten so big and so popular. We're now getting scripts from all around the world. I think here in the U.S., We've gotten scripts from at least half the states. I want to say 26. So, yeah, it takes a long time to prepare for this, because once the scripts start coming in, the committee has to read them. We have a first round of readers, and they read them blind. They have no idea whose play they're reading, so there's no favoritism, no nepotism, anything
no
like
kind of
that.
Ism.
Right, no isms there that I'm aware of. And then it gets whittled down. I read them along with a couple other people, and we settle on 8 plays.
So it's not just a festival, it is a contest as well.
It is a contest.
It's competitive.
Our playwrights, one of the things that Heartland really takes pride in is fostering these relationships with these writers, both with the 10-Minute Play Festival as well as new plays from the Heartland, which will take place as soon as this closes. We get started on that. In fact, we've already started on that.
Reese, in addition to being a director and an actor, you're also a writer. You've written plays as well. Can you tell us about the challenges of actually writing a 10-minute play?
Sure. Yeah. I think the biggest challenge is that you only have 10 minutes. So from the writer's standpoint, that means there's no time for lengthy exposition. You have to get right to it, cut to the chase, as it were. And you have to flesh those characters out really fast, which is difficult. You know, you don't want to end up with caricatures, which with that shortened format is a trap. It's a hazard. So you do your best to create a compelling story with three-dimensional characters with real depth in the space of 10 minutes. And then the challenges for the actor are much the same. You've got to hit the ground running and let the audience know what makes this character tick right away, because the clock is ticking, literally.
As one of the judges of the 10-Minute Play Festival, what are you looking for?
Not a gimmick. Often writers, this is in my experience, working within this format, they seize upon a certain hook or a gimmick that ends up being all the play is about. Kind of like a joke where everything hangs on the punchline. I'm more interested in pieces that have a little more mystery to them, that don't show everything up front. I'm looking for characters. Incidentally, there's a limit there. Our guidelines stipulate that you can't have more than 4 characters, again, for obvious reasons. You know, if you have a cast of thousands, yeah, in 10 minutes, pretty much all of those people are going to be spear carriers, and no one is going to have much to say at all. So, 4 characters, 1 location.
So this year, for the 10-Minute Play Festival, you have 8 plays.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we almost always do 8, 4 in the first act, 4 in the second.
The plays come from all over the country. You have something called Class Act from Dan Borengasser.
Borengasser, and this is, he holds the distinction of being our most produced playwright.
Ooh.
Of the 10-minute. This is the third time that he has submitted and won.
He's got the knack.
Yeah. We have playwrights coming from New York, Michigan, Chicago, Georgia, New Jersey, Indiana, Texas. And when I say coming from these places, a lot of these playwrights, they're literally coming. They want to see their plays produced, and so they make the trek.
So do they just watch it in performance, or do they help workshop it at all?
Well, that's a good question. I encourage the directors. We have 4 directors for the 10-Minute Play Festival. Each director, this year it's Dave Crostal, Irene Taylor, Rob Fulton, and Rob Good. They each direct 2 plays. And I encourage them to contact their playwrights and form a relationship. Talk about the plays. Certainly, if you're wanting to make any changes, we try to honor the script as it comes to us. So we really don't take many liberties unless something is absolutely necessary to make the evening work as a whole. Then we'll reach out to the playwright and say, hey, do you mind if we tweak this one little thing to help us out? And in almost all cases, they say, yeah, it's, you know, do what you need to do.
Tell me about the actors who will be performing in the 10-Minute Play Festival.
There are a number of actors who have acted in the festival many times before. Dave Lemon, Gail Hess. I tend to look at the 10-Minute Play Festival as one of our gateway plays. And what I mean by that is, you know, often if someone is interested in working at Heartland, acting on our stage, sometimes our season selection is a little daunting. You know, they feel like that's too much for me. Or it's simply a matter of I can't commit that much time. You know, I'm too busy. I cannot commit to 6 weeks of rehearsal, you know, 4 or 5 nights a week doing Three Sisters or something like that. So this is an opportunity for them to ease in, become known, and often a lot of those actors then become regular players on our stage.
Do you often sell out with this? Is this something where people need to get their tickets quickly?
We have sold out with this. Because it's such a large cast, that means your audience is going to be exponentially larger. But we also do an extra weekend. Typically, with our plays, we only do 3 weekends of performances. With the 10-Minute Play Festival, we run the entire month of June. So that gives people three more opportunities to see it.
So for your actors, certainly it's a good way to sort of get their feet wet with just a 10-minute play. But it's also good for audiences as well who maybe have never gone to Heartland Theater to see a production. You know, the 10-minute play festival, that's not a major commitment.
You're absolutely right. And we're always looking for new faces on both sides of the stage. And that's something that I say in all of my curtain speeches, you know, that we invite new talent. Certainly we invite new patrons. We're always looking to broaden our audience, grow our audience. And you're right, not everything that we produce is everyone's cup of tea. And with the 10-minute plays, you get a little sampling. It's sort of like a buffet or a
or a tea sampler.
A tea sampler. There you go. Yeah.
If you don't like what's on stage at that moment, just wait 10 minutes. You'll have something
else.
You
know, that's exactly what Mike Dobbins used to always say. Yeah. If you don't care for this one, just wait another 9-10 minutes and we'll be on to something else. So usually everybody walks away happy they've seen something that they like in the space of that 2 hours.
That's Reese Lovell, Artistic Director of Heartland Theater. The 10-Minute Play Festival is currently underway and runs through June 24th. I'm Laura Kennedy.
The new Heartland Theater season has also just been announced. Some of the highlights include Oscar Wilde's The Importance of Being Earnest coming in September, Three Tall Women by Edward Albee in November, and a rarity for Heartland Theater, a musical. They'll be staging the Obie Award-winning Floyd Collins next April.
Once upon a time, there were some eager gardeners who wanted to make something grow.
I planted roses.
I'm growing heirloom tomatoes.
Purple coneflower for me.
And they each ran into problems along the way.
Ew, black spots.
Wilt, so much wilt.
Is this supposed to be brown?
But I helped them out with that, and now their gardens really grow. My name is Murph. I can help you too. Send in your gardening questions to WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from CEFQ, partnering with car dealers throughout Central Illinois to make the auto loan process quick and convenient. Competitive rates for qualified buyers. Online pre-approval is available. CEFQ, not a bank, better. Details at CEFQ.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, a look at the Queen of the Blues in Detroit, who will be headlining the GLT Summer Concert coming up next week. And hate-related incidents appear to have spiked since last year's presidential election. Illinois was no exception. Advocates here argue an update to the state's hate crime law is overdue. For this week's Illinois Issues Report, Daisy Contreras talked with reporter Maureen McKinney about what is being done in Illinois.
Several of my sources have talked about the anti-immigrant and anti-Muslim rhetoric that emboldened individuals with strong bias to express that in sometimes ugly ways after hearing that kind of thing in the campaign. Leisha Brooks' organization, the Southern Poverty Law Center, tracked hate incidences post-election, and here's what she had to say.
It really seemed to echo the rhetoric that began during the campaign. You recall that it started with the anti-immigrant and anti-Mexican rhetoric. It wasn't surprising at all that we saw that the primary motivation for the majority of the bias incidents that happened across the country, the number one motivation was anti-immigrant.
I asked Brooks' center to come up with a list of hate-related incidents that occurred in Illinois since the election, and it turned out to be a list of 56 events between the election and the end of March when I made the request. The list includes incidents throughout the state, such as the forced removal of Muslim women's headscarves, the placement of racist, homophobic, and anti-Semitic posters on campuses, the smashing of glass, and the placement of swastikas at a synagogue, and the defacement of a Quran at a suburban library.
So can you define what a hate crime is?
It's a criminal activity such as assault, battery, theft, and disorderly conduct against a specific individual or community because of race, color, creed, ancestry, gender, sexual orientation, physical or mental disability, or national origin. This is how Attorney General Lisa Madigan explains.
Hate crimes are something that is not just an attack on an individual, but it is a crime that is motivated with the goal of attacking a religion, somebody's race, somebody's way of life, and it is intended to have a broader impact as opposed to just harming an individual. It aims to harm a community, and that is why hate crimes laws were passed in the first place. But unfortunately, we're seeing a circumstance in the United States right now where we need to be more proactive and engaged and responsive as law enforcement to make sure that this doesn't continue.
So in response to this rash of incidents, is there anything new that's being done here in Illinois to combat hate crime?
Governor Bruce Rauner in March announced a series of initiatives, such as the development of a statewide standardized training plan for local police and for the state police. It's being run through the Illinois State Police, the Anti-Defamation League, and the Illinois Law Enforcement Training Board. The plan also calls for expanding anti-hate crime education in the schools. In the statement in March, Rauner said he would order the Department of Human Services Director Janice Glenn to develop and implement a department policy to make sure complaints filed with the department that rise to the level of hate crime are referred to local law enforcement. Meanwhile, he's supporting legislation that would strengthen the hate crime law. Rauner says he will sign that bill, which was sponsored by Oswego Democratic Representative Stephanie Kifowit. Kifowit says the idea for the legislation was brought to her by Sadia Covert, a representative of the Islamic Center of Naperville.
We noticed that although Illinois had a good hate crime law, I felt like that the language could have been improved and tightened up a little bit more, so it would be easier for police officers and other law enforcement officials and prosecutors to understand. HB 2390, I think, is a powerful bill in that it offers education for people who commit hate crimes. It has a civil component where, you know, families can file a civil suit against the perpetrator. The thing about hate, people are not born hateful. It's something that is developed over time, and it derives out of ignorance or a lack of knowledge.
So apart from this measure, what other initiatives are being considered?
Attorney General Lisa Madigan is backing House Bill 3711, which was approved by both the House and the Senate and now goes to the governor's desk. Rauner's representatives wouldn't say whether he would sign the measure, which adds stalking, cyber stalking, and intimidation as punishable hate crimes. Here's what Attorney General Lisa Madigan had to say.
And so in part what we did to update this for the 21st century was to make sure that we were capturing a number of the ways that people are committing hate crimes these days. So there's a significant increase in the use of technology, as anybody who spends any amount of time on the internet, on social media, can tell you. And so we made sure to include cyberstalking and certain acts of intimidation that deal with the increased use of technology to commit hate crimes.
And so does hate crime cover issues beyond religion from your research?
Yes. In addition to race and disability, other areas covered by the Illinois law are sexual preference and gender status, for instance. Here's what the Equality Illinois representative Mike Zuri had to say.
Violence has been a present, you know, condition in the lives of many LGBTQ people for years now. We know that in 2015, one-fifth of the hate crimes reported to the FBI were because of the victim's sexual orientation or gender identity. So a full 20% of the hate crimes in 2015 reported. And, you know, we know from Chicago Police Department statistics that there was a 20% increase in hate crimes between 2015 and 2016. And we know that the majority of hate crimes in Chicago between 2012 and 2015 were attacks on Black and gay men. There's been a lot of focus since the election on hate crimes across the country, as there should be. But the violence in LGBTQ people's lives has been a very present condition for as long as we've been coming out and being ourselves.
Zuri also expressed an idea about what might motivate someone to commit a hate crime.
You know, of course, there's hatred in the world of individuals who are different from, you know, the vast majority of society. There's also miseducation, misunderstanding. I think you see that when it comes to hate crimes against LGBTQ people. Sometimes folks fear and hate what they don't understand.
IPR's Daisy Contreras spoke with Maureen McKinney about hate crimes in Illinois.
Please me, that don't appease me. Well, your sorries ain't sincere. So get the heck on out of here. No. That don't appease me.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Thornetta Davis headlines the GLT Summer Concert June 10th on the Square in downtown Bloomington. Los Tex Maniacs and Edward David Anderson's Black Dirt Revival also perform. Davis is known as Detroit's Queen of the Blues. She talked with GLT's John Norton about how she fell into blues and how she acquired her royal status in Detroit.
Prior to 2015, Queen Alberta Adams was the Queen of Detroit Blues.
Oh, okay.
And she was one of my mentors. And we would do gigs together around the country or Canada. And R.J. Spangler, who was her manager, would always put us together at shows. But she was the queen, and she passed away, I think it was 2014. And in her last gig, the Blues Society gave a Blues Girls of Summer show, which had a bunch of the girls who sing blues around the Detroit metropolitan area, and Miss Alberta Adams. And this was her last show. And I remember one of the last things she said was, I wish I could sing like you, and this is all a video thing. She did not want to give up the mic. I think we had all jammed on Every Day I Had a Blues for like 15 minutes. And we had to move on with the show, and so they kept telling me, try to get the mic from Alberta. And I was like, Alberta, they want to move on. And she wouldn't. Took the mic, like, no, nope, I don't want to, you know. And you can actually Google this and see it on YouTube. I when I saw it, it just made things tears in my eyes.
Oh, wow.
She handed me the mic, and that was the last time.
This album, Honest Woman, which, by the way, what an album. This is fantastic.
Thank you.
Yeah, you've got a number of recognizable guests for those who know the blues world pretty well. Kim Wilson, on a song, Larry McCrae on another song. And what caught my eye was the late Marcus Belgrave.
Thank you for bringing reference to you.
Yeah, the jazz trumpet player who just passed away here recently. The song Get Up and Dance Away Your Blues. Have you or had you been friends with Marcus and even his wife Joan?
Yeah, here in Detroit. He used to tell me, because it took me a long time to actually get the album out of my system and onto a disc. He would always say, whenever you need me, just let me know. And when I decided to go into the studio with that song, I said, Marcus, I want you on this song here. And he came in, and him and a couple of other great horn players, Racy Biggs, Ed Gooch, came in and just tore it up. And I said, put the magic on.
No matter what your age, you reach your part, trouble disappear when you're on the floor. Get up.
Got his own distinguished history, you know, playing with all these great names, including Ray Charles, and had his own jazz albums and that.
Exactly. Yeah, he was a local living legend here at the time. You know, he was Marcus. Everybody knew Marcus Belgrave, but he was all of our friends too. He wasn't inaccessible. He would just come and jam with you.
Another song on the album, the second track after the opening track with your sister, it references you refusing to live in the past.
Right.
And it's talking about, you know, you understand why you sing the blues, or someone would understand why you sing the blues if they walked a mile in your shoes, basically.
Yeah.
Are you referencing a tough early life?
Yeah, you know, I grew up, my mom raised four girls by herself. With the help of my grandmother, who lived upstairs from us. But, you know, it was a upbringing of turmoil. At first, my father, he was an alcoholic, and he was kind of violent. He was quite violent, actually. And when my mother finally got out of that situation, that's when I felt like I started to live, you know. And music was my savior. I would go to music and sing around the house, you know, just to anything, a TV show, a commercial. I just always loved music, and when I became able to perform in school, I was too nervous and shy to audition. So when I got into high school, you didn't have to audition for a girls' glee class. You just had to take the class. That's what started my career.
Huh,
and when I started singing the blues, I was a single mom. Didn't realize I was going to be able to do all these things. I put it through college and just prayed on it, and God kept me safe. Sometimes we had money, sometimes we didn't, but you always made it through. And that's the blues in itself.
People keep asking why I sang the blues. I say it's easy for me. If you take time to walk in my shoes, the blues comes easy, you see. But I refuse to stay in the past. There are times that come and they go. I live my life like today is the last. That's why I want you all to know that I gotta sing the blues.
You're listening to GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton with Thornetta Davis. Detroit's Queen of the Blues is going to headline our GLT summer concert. Well, you talked about how Marcus and folks like that were always ready to help out. But you grew up with your mom. How important was your mom to...
Oh, my mom and my sisters and my grandmother. We all lived in a two-family flat. My grandmother lived downstairs, and my mother and I and all of my sisters lived upstairs. And so just to have that matriarch family all together, when my mother would go to work and leave all of us, my grandmother took over, made sure we were okay, and was always loving the house. And we didn't go outside the house too much to play with too many people. In our neighborhood, living in the ghetto and growing up in not so nice neighborhood, it was best for us to just hang out with each other, you know, until we knew what was up growing up. But crack and drugs was always around in my neighborhood.
We
managed to make it through all of that without getting involved in any of that ourselves.
All this time, said I'd given up on love. Told myself a good man didn't exist. Yes. But now
You decided to name your album Honest Woman. Why?
Well, you know, it took me to be honest with myself and to be honest with these songs. The songs that you're listening to is all about me telling my business, you know? If you listen to the lyrics, you'll see my journey from the first one on through. It starts off where I've been in bad relationships, but I've grown from it and learned something. And when I wrote Honest Woman, by that time I had met and been married to my husband, James. And then so it had a double meaning when they say, you made an honest woman of her. When he married me, he made an honest woman out of her.
Thornetta Davis, so nice to talk to you, and I know people are going to love you at the GLT Summer Concert. We're looking forward to seeing you.
Thank you. I'm bringing a bunch of CDs, and I'm looking for some people to start dancing. The way you dance and choose.
Honest Woman by Thornetta Davis. Speaking with GLT's John Norton, Davis headlines the GLT Summer Concert Saturday, June 10th on the Square in downtown Bloomington. Edward David Anderson's Black Dirt Revival and Los Tex Maniacs also perform. Thanks to John Norton and Laura Kennedy for today's edition of Sound Ideas. Hear the stories and find full episodes at WGLT.org. This is WGLT Normal. To take away the cold.